From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on April 9th, 2003, in Baghdad, Iraq. A 39-foot statue of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein had stood in Firdos Square, directly in front of the Palestine Hotel, which happened to be where international journalists had been staying. U.S. soldiers wrapped a chain around the neck of that statue using an M-88 armored recovery vehicle. A group of Iraqi citizens surrounded the statue as it came down. Once the statue hit the ground, you might remember, citizens dragged it and stomped on it, eventually ripping the head off. The destruction was widely shown in both video and still images. Most of the images showed tight shots of what appeared to be a large celebratory crowd. A few minutes after the toppling, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld told reporters, quote, "The scenes of free Iraqis celebrating in the streets, riding American tanks, tearing down the statue of Saddam Hussein in the center of Baghdad are breathtaking. Watching them, one cannot help but think of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Iron Curtain," end quote. But did those photographs tell an accurate story? Much less publicized at the time were the wide-angle images that showed the full scene. Beyond that rather small mob of Iraqis, the streets were essentially empty. Far from a sea of people, it was lightly populated. With the wide-angle shot, it would have been difficult to conclude that this event was proof that Iraq was satisfied with the war. In The New Yorker, Peter Moss wrote, quote, "Robert Capa once said, if your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough. And generations of journalists have followed that maxim. But the opposite can also be true. The farther away you are, the better you can see. At Firdos Square in Baghdad, the farther from the statue you were, the more you could understand," end quote. So was it unethical to publish tight-shot photographs of that small crowd? Did it tell an inaccurate story? How do headlines and captions impact the portrayal of images? And let's go beyond that. Right now, the Bronx Documentary Center is showing an exhibit titled Altered Images, 150 Years of Posed and Manipulated Documentary Photography. These are images you've probably seen. O.J. Simpson on the cover of Time magazine, an image apparently darkened to add a kind of sinister effect. Another shows missiles being fired, but an extra missile photoshopped in. Photojournalist Michael Camber put the exhibit together to make all of us think about ethics in photojournalism. So when is it okay to change or edit an image for news purposes? Is it ever okay? My guest for the hour will help us go through that. Max Schulte is here, the Democrat and Chronicle's lead photographer. Nice to have you, Max.
Good to be here.
Lorette Steinberg's here, an RIT professor who teaches one of the only ethics and photography courses in the country. Great to have you, Lorette.
It's good to be here.
And also here is William Snyder, a four-time Pulitzer-winning photographer and editor, now a professor at his alma mater, RIT. Nice to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
There are so many different directions we could go. Let's start with the example of the Saddam statue. William Snyder, was it unethical to publish only tight-shot photos in newspapers that we saw initially?
Well, I think that's the key word, only. Context is always important. What you hope is that you have available that photograph so that editors, smart journalistic editors, will look at both and make a decision. Maybe they run both. Maybe they do show the overall to give a sense of place and a sense of context, and then they run the tighter things to give you a sense of what it was like to be in the middle of that.
I suppose at that moment, with Donald Rumsfeld sort of saying, hey, this is the moment that you can see, everyone is celebrating, there was a feeling of being swept up. I recall seeing those images, whether it was the video, even the video were kind of tight shots, et cetera. Does the photojournalist, and that's an important term we're going to talk about in a moment, does the photojournalist, William, have an obligation to make sure there's communication with a newsroom, maybe continents away, that here's the context, understand this, be careful with the caption, know this about X, Y, and Z?
Well, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. As we are going to get into a little bit deeper, I hope. I mean, our job primarily is to be journalists first, then photographers. And unfortunately, there are some that are out there only interested in the photograph. But a really good photojournalist is going to put it in their caption and perhaps refer to another frame that they're going to move or have moved. You know, the problem with a scene like what you're talking about is most of the photographers that were covering those things were not working for any one agency or any one publication. They're generally working for larger agencies where the images will go out. So hundreds if not thousands of publications around the world. So 9 times out of 10, what we hope is that the photojournalist will do their job in writing the caption or in communicating to their editors in the caption you know, when the editors have to write the caption.
Because there would be a big difference if the caption said, in an event staged by the U.S. military, a small crowd of Iraqis cheered a statue's fall, or if a caption says, Baghdad cheered as a large Saddam statue crashed down, totally different meanings.
Exactly. Exactly. And you would hope, again, you would hope that the photojournalist on site would do that, would write that properly. You know, when I was at the Dallas Morning News, those sorts of things in the captions were really, really important. Captions, in many, many ways, are the ones that, that provide the context and provide the real information for photojournalists' work. You can do all sorts of things in captions that you can't necessarily do in the image as far as giving it context. There, you know, we talk about lies. I don't think any journalist knowingly lies, but sometimes there are lies of omission, sometimes on purpose and sometimes by, you know, inexperience and you know, mistakes.
The cynics, after all of that happened, those who decried the Iraq War from the beginning, Max Schulte, said, well, hey, even the photographers on the scene were swept up in it. They were standing there. They knew it wasn't that large of a crowd, but they knew their shot could go around the world if they got it just right. And I thought that was a little too cynical. But is there pressure to get that great singular shot? Is there too much emphasis on creating art instead of creating journalism?
I mean, look, every photographer, especially in a war zone, is going to have a little bit of extra adrenaline going through their system. I mean, people who photograph in these situations are putting their life on the line. That being said, they also have a deep commitment usually to the craft because they are, you know, putting themselves in harm's way. And they are pretty true to, or they are trying to stay true to, the ethics that follow photojournalists. That being said, there are people who actually chase conflict and photograph conflict and alter images. They don't have, they're doing this on their own, mm-hmm. and they don't report back to, say, a photo editor or a picture agency that's going to hold them accountable. They're selling their images to bloggers, Vice News, other organizations that might not have the traditional ties to the journalistic ethics that, you know, some places try to really, you know, keep in focus and in the forefront of their employees' minds at all times. So, yes, I mean, it's easy to get caught up in that. It's easy to get wrapped up in a fluid situation that's moving. I remember one picture from that event. It was an Iraqi who had a shoe,
yep.
Bashing the face of Saddam Hussein. You know, is that image not representative of what was going on? I would argue that it was. Would have been better served if maybe the photographer got an interpreter and actually got a quote from that gentleman to put in the caption, might have strengthened the image.
Max, some of your work is the kind of work that our listeners might not realize. They've seen your images. You've done remarkable work over the years at the Democrat and Chronicle. And now, and I'll ask Lorette the same kind of question in a moment here, we have seen newsrooms, understandably so, around the country making decisions on how best to go forward, how best to stay afloat, sometimes at the expense of certain parts of the staff. When you talk to younger people coming into this business, are you concerned that there is a lack of, or let me actually strip that back and say, is there a newsroom at the Democrat and Chronicle? Is there a newsroom sort of a mission statement on what photojournalism is and isn't?
Well, the photographers are upheld to the same standards as the writers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we are there to document what is going on in our community in an ethical and truthful manner. We're there to present our readers with a factual look at events. I can't tell you how many times I walk into you know, a typical business job or, you know, a features assignment, you know, that we're there to document somebody doing something, and the subject will say, well, you know what, we got done with that yesterday, but you know what, we'll stage that for you. And I have to have the, you know, conversation. Listen, that's against our ethics policy. You know, we're here to document what really takes place, whether it's, you know, you doing your art or you making a widget or, you know, whatever that may be. We need to be there to document the actual events as opposed
but
to staging
them. But he'll say, Max,
them.
But we did it yesterday. It's no big deal. I just got to move this one chair, move this. That's all.
I've walked out of places before. It's something that we just don't do. Obviously, there's solutions around that. Do you take, if, you know, you're on deadline and you need something, you know, you can always fall back on an environmental portrait, you know, which isn't a staged photo. It's a, you know, an image of somebody in their environment looking at the camera. There's an implied look back to the viewer that this picture was set up. And that, and I don't want to say, you know, set up in a bad way, but, you know, it was a portrait. It wasn't so much of an event or staged image.
We're talking photojournalism ethics this hour, and one of the only photojournalism, or I should say photo and ethics courses that I know of in the country is taught by Lorette Steinberg at RIT. And what prompted this discussion is that new exhibit in the Bronx Documentary Center right now called Altered Images, 150 Years of Posed and Manipulated Documentary Photography. And the photojournalist who put that together, Mr. Camber, told the New York Times, quote, "If people would stop faking photos, then they wouldn't have to be worried about being called out. It's a betrayal. Just get it right. Don't change things. Don't direct your students, or don't direct your subjects. Don't lie in your captions. Don't move pixels. Get it right. That's what we're here to do." End quote. Lorette Steinberg, that's a drilling it down very simply kind of a quote. Do you agree with him, or is that oversimplified?
Absolutely. I don't think it's oversimplifying. It's just that in that simple statement, there are a lot of complexities. And a lot of people don't understand what those complexities are. You know, Max just talked about not setting up something. Well, one of the complexities that's attached to that, when people are saying, well, what's the big deal, is the fact that somebody finding out or knowing that you set it up, you lose your credibility. And that's one of the reasons why you have somebody like Edward Keating actually losing his job with the New York Times when he posed the young man, the child in Lackawanna, New York. Is the New York Times simply didn't want to run the risk of losing credibility for all of their editorial content. And the professional photographer, you understand that your reputation is at stake as well. The problem that we're having now is it's not just the photographer who's moving the images and who's doing something with the images. I understand this from a couple of different positions because I'm a photographer too, you know, and I wrestle with the same thing, like, wow, I didn't see that behind that person. Oh, you know, that's distracting over there. I totally understand those issues. However, I understand the importance of what we do in relation to our function in society. We're a democratic society where people are relying upon our good journalism. It may be in photographs, but it's good journalism to help them to understand the world, to understand their relationship to the world, and also to help them make more informed decisions when they're politically involved.
I was a journalism student of Terry Anderson's at Ohio University. And I remember Terry Anderson saying that the example he used, he said, you could lose your career over what you think is one good story. And he gave an example, and now with the passage of time, I don't want to mistake too many of the details, but he essentially said, you know, take the reporter who is in an impoverished area, and you get this moment of children going through a trash can looking for food. Are you going to tell your readers and your viewers that you threw food into a garbage can to make them go get it before you took that image? Because that kind of thing has happened. And when that's discovered, it's over for you. So that's an obvious point. But let's take a point that a lot of people kind of have talked about and is part of this exhibit, the question of cannonballs in Crimea or the war reporter who shows up. William Snyder, you're a war reporter. Hypothetically, generally speaking, you're a war reporter. You show up on a crowded, war-torn street. A city's been shelled. There are shell casings on an empty street, and they're all over the place. And you're thinking, this is a great shot, and you're essentially hustling to get your gear out, and someone comes right by and street sweeps, and all the shells go to the side, and then the street's empty again. Well, in this case, in Crimea, you had the reporter, the journalist, simply reposition the cannonballs or reposition the shells on the street where they thought they were because they had been swept aside. And 5 minutes before, you had this incredible moment of the aftermath. And he says, well, I'm just going to reposition those cannonballs, those shells on the street, and then I'll get the shot. It will be essentially the same. No one will be the wiser. And I don't think it is, the journalist may say, I don't think it's an ethical breach because that is what was what has happened.
Well, we once had a colleague who had the would you kick the gun test. And what that was basically you showed up first to a crime scene and there's a dead body there and there's a gun laying there. But it's just in the wrong spot for a really great picture. Do you sort of kick it over to where it makes a really good picture? Look, the short version of all of this is no, you don't do any of this. You know, if you're talking about the Crimean War, you know, you're talking about a time when these ethics didn't exist. Look, when I came up X number of years ago, you know, setting up pictures to a degree, you know, hey, do that again. Yeah, you did it yesterday. Do it again today. That was still somewhat acceptable. But that was in the late 70s or very early 80s. But quickly in the 80s, that changed. And I mean, the basic thing is, no, you don't do that stuff. You know, to your initial idea, shoot the picture of the people sweeping up the shells. I mean, I think that's an even better picture than just them sitting there. You've got somebody doing something. It talks about, you know, what this means, how this affects the public. You know, I mean, a large part of the problem is too many photographers, and especially young photographers now, think that their vision, their version, their idea of a story is what's important. Now, I have a lot of students that don't want to go into a story with a particular bias, but yet they already have it. They know, quote unquote, what the story is. So, for example, you walk in there with that idea as, oh, I want to get this picture of these shells all over the street. And so that's the only thing you're focused on. What we always tell our students is the story is what you find, not what you want, not what you think it should be, but what do you find? Mm-hmm. So that speaks to Max's situation earlier. You know, you want to photograph reality as close to truthfully as you can. That didn't come out quite right. But anyway, I think you understand what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, we are human beings. We have our biases, we have the way we look at the world, we have all that. But deep down, the best of us are trying to be as honest as we humanly can be. Do we always succeed? No. But here's also, speaking to Lorette's point, I want to gild this lily just a little bit. News organizations, like this one that we're sitting in right now, we have only one thing for sale, and that is trust. Trust from the public that what we present to them is as close to the truth as we possibly can be. And every single time one of our members, be it a writer or a photographer, an editor, a producer, whatever, you know, starts fudging with the truth, we lose a little bit of the trust of the public. And so, again, when I was the director, what I told everybody was, if there's a question, err on the side of don't touch it, don't do anything. Set up a portrait, come back later, walk away. Because our reputations as you know, purveyors of truth, quote unquote, and purveyors of trust are always on the line. And your career as a photographer, your art as a photographer, doesn't enter into it.
You're hearing from William Snyder, and I want our listeners to understand just how distinguished our panel is this hour. He's a four-time Pulitzer-winning photographer, an editor, and a professor at RIT now. Lorette Steinberg, an RIT professor who teaches really one of the only ethics and photography courses in the country. And Max Schulte, the Democrat and Chronicle lead photographer. How long ago was the last image you had published in the Democrat and Chronicle, Max?
Well, are we talking in the print or are we talking online?
Both. That's really both now.
Yeah, really. You know, so much of our content now is, you know, we're thinking on a digital first platform,
yep.
You know. So much of our work is having a longevity online. You know, we have photo galleries on there. We have stories on there that are still gaining traction, even though they've been up there for 2 weeks. I have.
But your stuff's up there all the time.
Yeah, our stuff is up there all the time.
And how much? Given how much editing availability you have, I mean, look, I can take a picture of the cell phone and edit the heck out of it now. It really is remarkable what technology does. And that is not comparing. I'm a terrible photographer in general. I'm not comparing my work to yours in any way. What I'm simply saying is the world has changed to allow us to edit so quickly, so easily. How much editing, if any, are you doing images?
Our rule of thumb right now, the term photoshopped in the photojournalism community is actually a dirty word. I mean, that's Photoshop means that the picture was altered. Do I use Photoshop on a daily basis? Yes, I use Photoshop every day. But I'm using it in a responsible way where I'm toning images for highlights, I'm toning images for shadows and midtones. I'm color correcting because I was in fluorescent light and things look a little bit green and I just need to bring the whites in a little bit better. I am not going in and using cloning tools. I am not going in and putting other people in images. I am not going in and staging putting images together to stage something that isn't realistic. You know, we just had a pretty high-profile case, murder case, that we were the pool photographer for, and the judge was fairly concerned about us taking pictures inside the courtroom and capturing some of the folks in the gallery. And basically said to our photographer, I said, well, look, I really want to control this background. And I would ask that you blur the background. And, our photographer said, look, Judge, I can't do that. That's against our ethics, okay? I can't use Photoshop as a tool to distort what's happening in our community. And again, that gets back to William's discussion about trust. And, the judge said, well, what if I order you to? You'll have to. Okay, I don't think he meant he was going to order us to Photoshop the image. What he meant was you need to be aware that I'm ordering you not to photograph people in the gallery in the background. Now we took care. We were able to handle that by closing the depth of field using very shallow depth of field. The subject would be the defendant and his attorneys. We used selective editing in terms of erring on the side of what William was talking about, if you have a question or if you think that there's an issue with the image, you err on the side of caution in these situations. The other road that took us down was an ethical one of censorship because, we were basically being told that we couldn't photograph the gallery, which was kind of an important part to this case. But that was a decision we were going to be able to live with because we thought it was more important to be able to bring those images from the courtroom with that stipulation from the court than not be in there at all.
Okay, and you mentioned color correction, for example. Is it fair to say that if you are manipulating color, it is out of an effort to bring the image as close to what you think is reality or truth as possible as opposed to something artistic or for an emotional effect?
I mean, look, green grass on a golf course should be green grass on a golf course. If you are trying to match that green to what you remember, then you fall within the ethical realms of trying to bring truth to the image.
But that is different than Time magazine darkening an image of O.J. Simpson on the cover for an obvious emotional manipulative effect.
I mean, altering somebody's skin tone from what they look like is obviously that's a breach of trust because you've taken somebody's image and altered the way that they actually look in person.
All right, both of our other panelists want to jump in. Lorette Steinberger?
Well, I think Max brings up an important point in terms of how he's preparing the image. You introduced that idea. We have this mistake that actually began in 1839 when photography was first announced, the invention of photography was first announced, when people said, aha, now we have this device and science that can show us the truth. And of course, any photographer knows that a simple mechanical recording of something that was in front of the camera is not the truth. What a photographer tries to do is to compensate for the technology and its various flaws, and there are many, and I don't need to list them all here, to make the image represent what a reasonable viewer standing over our shoulder might have seen when we made that photograph. And that is our responsibility. And at that point, we start thinking about what do we do after that? I mean, even cropping, people moan about cropping. Well, isn't that manipulation? Well, you know, everybody knows that the photograph puts a frame around reality. Cropping is that. But even within cropping, we have a responsibility to understand whether or not we're manipulating an understanding of the scene by the way we crop something. With Max and with the gallery, you have two opposing issues going on. You have the fair trial issue as well, which I would say is fairly significant, as well as, you know, our First Amendment rights to know what's going on.
A whole nother show.
Right. It is. Absolutely.
And a whole other show is how poor of a job I think judges tend to do, even out of good intention, of realizing that when a courtroom is open, it's supposed to be open.
And we forget, too, we think that ethics is a set number of rules, like a list of sins. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And actually, if you look at the history of ethics and ethical philosophy over time, it's developed and evolved as society has. We continually go back and we question. We still hold some basic core standards, but as society changes, we have to revisit those. And as photographers, we recognize that our profession demands that we understand new issues that arise that we couldn't have foreseen some time ago. So that's part of it, too, is thinking about whether or not you blur out the jury, you know, just because you can. That becomes something that we have to discuss and that we have to come to some consensus with.
Well, all I really wanted to do was jump in there and sort of, you touched on a personal bugaboo of mine. I hate this word edit to refer to processing an image.
Yes. Okay. I do too.
To me, and the way I teach my students, and hopefully everybody out there in the world and in our world goes along with this, to edit a picture is to choose one out of a group of photographs. To process the image is to change those things, is to do those things.
To alter them.
Well, not necessarily alter them. Okay. To do what Max was talking about, and then if you're going to go further, then you're talking about altering. I don't want to go there. That's not what we do. But I think that's one of the issues that has crept in there. It's the looseness of the language. Mm-hmm. Suddenly it's become the idea that if you're editing an image, you're actually changing it as opposed to selecting it. And I think while some people would argue, you know, you're just picking at little things, I think it's significant from the standpoint of the mindset that when you blur these lines about choosing a picture versus manipulating a picture, and you equate those two things in a single word, I think that's one reason we have the issues that we do. You know, everybody out there says, well, what difference does it make? Well, again, it all gets back to this trust thing that we've already gone over ad nauseum. And I think that the language should be clear. You know, we edit, we choose pictures, we process those images that we choose. And so for those of you out there listening to this, I hope you begin to adopt this language.
Absolutely. And you know, starting with the host, by the way, and William, again, I just want to make sure we're clear with our listeners. You were not only a photojournalist, but an editor for Dallas Morning News, for example.
Yes.
So as an editor, that you are choosing
the
photographs to use here. Lorette?
And I'll add to that, too, what William's also referring to. Thus far, we've been talking about the single image. You know, which image do you choose? You know, we've all seen, you know, an entire take, and there's that one image that is just totally different from anything else that happened. You choose that image. Why do you choose that image? Ethically, is that the thing that shows the story? But you're also referring to, I'm sure, not just the single image, but which images you put together, because that can really, really control the story that you're seeing.
Sure. And when it comes to the job of an editor, choosing an image is a powerful position. Mm-hmm. I think, for example, I think it was in January, maybe February, the New York Times did what I thought was largely an excellent 5-minute sort of a new media. It was kind of digital storytelling using still images set to a little bit of music, which I'm always a little bit on the edge about using music in a journalistic sense because music is always for manipulative purposes. But they were telling the story of the fall of Kodak and the impact on Rochester. And they came here and they shot beautiful images. You know, they shot really high angle shots looking down at huge empty parking lots, and that has a powerful effect. The one thing that really rubbed me the wrong way was an image of the tent city, the homeless tent city under 490, as they talked about job loss, which was essentially unconnected. You know, that was only 30 or 40 tents. And to imply that all of a sudden Rochester has this huge homeless tent city population related to Kodak, I thought that was wrong. And I don't know if that was out of ignorance or out of just, hey, this is a great image and we're going to use it anyway. But I was bothered by that.
Well, one of the things, too, is that they're talking about Kodak leaving the city now. Kodak has been leaving the city for some time. So it's not like we're just now going, oh, my God, there are no jobs. You know, we have been struggling as a city to recover from the loss of industry. So they're making a connection that actually is untrue.
And I would argue that that was irresponsible because what they should have done was gone into the tent city and knocked on the tent doors and said, hey, any of you guys work at Kodak?
Are any of you here because you lost your jobs at Kodak?
Exactly. So you know, so the lack of journalistic integrity there made them fall short of the mark.
Well, we already had a question online. Mark wanted to know if photojournalists are artists. It's an interesting question, but if you missed it earlier, William Snyder said, first and foremost, a photojournalist is a journalist before even being a photographer.
Yes. I mean, you know, this has been sort of an ongoing discussion argument in the industry for years, especially now that there are more and more gallery showings that feature documentary work. You know, all journalism can be art, but I wouldn't necessarily say that art is journalism.
Is there a risk with magazine covers and, you know, all of these things? Is there a risk that the pull towards that artistic looking image?
Well, first of all, you raise another issue with the magazine cover. Now, there are editors who contend that the magazine cover is a point of purchase display ad, and therefore they can take more latitude.
Do you agree? Does our panel agree with that?
No.
No.
Well, wait.
They claim that.
I think it depends on the publication. So, for example, you know, the most famous one, at least for me, was National Geographic moving the pyramid so that it would fit. So that
retroactive they would fit. Repositioning.
Yeah, you know, or any of that. Time Magazine, you know, God love them. I mean, I love the people at Time Magazine, and this kind of comes from somewhere else. If you look at their international cover, it continually is covered with news, and for me, it's a great cover. In the U.S., oh, my God, it's just, I mean, I think it's Jon Stewart or Colbert used to make unending fun of them. So I think it depends on the publication. If you're talking about Elle Magazine or Food and Wine, that's one thing. If you're talking about Time Magazine or National Geographic or Newsweek, now we're talking about a whole different thing.
And that comes back to the issue, too, where most ethicists will say, whatever you do, people should know what you've done. So, for example, if you have, as Spy Magazine once had, is our vice president of the United States with a dunce cap sitting on a brick, you have to indicate that it's an illustration. You have to indicate it in more than 6-point type on the third page in. I'd like to get back to the idea of art. Now, I have an MFA. I have shown work as an artist, and I do largely now, I still cover some things from time to time, but I largely do documentary work, which is a longer, more reflective component of photojournalism. I know the difference, and I have to know the difference. There is an artfulness in the way that a good photojournalist makes a photograph, that these are the devices that we use to make sense of the world. A photojournalist has to look at the world and understand how to organize the frame, the elements in the frame, to establish a contextual relationship between, say, where you're sitting and the door can create something. If that door is open, I'm going to be looking at you and the open door, and I'm going to start building that story, that narrative in my head, because we are so hardwired for narrative stories, okay? So that is artful. There's an artfulness to it. But actually, in terms of art, I don't understand why so many photojournalists want to call themselves artists as if that had a greater cachet than really good, strong photojournalism. Art is something else. And most artists would say that.
Yeah, it's an interesting – I'm way late for a break. We're going to get a break in a second. I'll just end that quick point by saying, Max, in going through some of your work in the last 24 hours, there are moments where I look at an image that you have and I say, wow, I mean, that is powerful. You know, that – to me, that almost looks artistic. But I now I'm careful not to put it in those terms because that would even imply something about you that is – then you're doing anything other than – telling a story accurate.
I mean, but if you get back to the fundamentals of what photography is, it's painting with light, right? I mean, you are looking for light to expose an image. So light has a powerful dynamic in how you go about composing and all these things and looking for that dramatic image that Lorette was talking about. So, yes, I mean, does an art background or an understanding of art help me make compelling images? Yes. Is that in the back of my head when I'm photographing? Yes, but my journalistic, you know, cap is also on. So I need to balance the two of those to create the images I'm making.
But I'll jump in. I know you got to go very quickly. I mean, think about it this way: there's great writing that you know is artistic. It is so well done, journalistic writing. I mean, it's so well done that it crosses that line into just beautiful prose. We do the same thing. There's nothing wrong with it. But if you're a slave to that as opposed to the journalistic part of it, that's where you run into the problems.
Jake writes to us, there are plenty of tools out there to detect Photoshop images with fairly high degrees of accuracy. Do your guests use them? We're going to start there when we come back from this break as we talk about ethics and photojournalism on this outstanding panel right here on Connection. Stay with us. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli. He recaps the recent legislative session. We'll talk about taxes and tax rebates, spending on schools. We'll talk about MMA, the minimum wage. And we'll talk about many other issues as well, answering your phone calls with Joe Morelli. Next hour, in studio on Connections.
In med school, healthy eating hasn't been part of the curriculum.
I did a 4-year extra intensive training program in cardiology and didn't receive 1 minute of training in nutrition.
But that's changing.
A quick granola?
Banana nut muffin.
Breakfast tacos?
Teaching docs to prescribe eating right later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. We're learning a great deal this hour as we talk about modern photojournalism and ethics in photojournalism. Max Schulte is the Democrat and Chronicle's lead photographer. William Snyder, a 4-time Pulitzer-winning photographer and editor, and now a professor at RIT, as is Lorette Steinberg, who teaches one of the nation's only ethics and photography classes. And this discussion was prompted in large part by a new exhibit in the Bronx Documentary Center right now, titled Altered Images, 150 Years of Posed and Manipulated Documentary Photography. So the notion of, well, they didn't have photoshopping 100 years ago, I don't think, but the notion of altering images is not new. It is maybe a bit more sophisticated now, and Jake wanted to know, given what he says, there are tools to help catch photoshopped images. Are they in use, Lorette Steinberg?
There are tools that are in use for doing that, but most people cannot afford to use them or hire the experts to use them. And you're not going to do it for the number of photographs that come across your desk when you're editing all the time. Hani Farid, F-A-R-I-D, is one of the people who's been trying to develop software for such things. And in fact, Photo District News just had an article on June 9th, How World Press Photo Catches Image Manipulators. That actually is a good read. But one of the things I'll read briefly, many of these techniques for image analysis are out of reach for most news organizations to use routinely. Farid founded a company, Is It True, I-Z-I-T-R-U, clever, right? Mm-hmm. That offers a free authentication app for consumers and businesses, but it doesn't use all the modeling techniques and forensic search like the one conducted for World Press Photo. So if you consider, you know, you can ask William and Max how many photographs came across their desk every day. you know, would you be able to do that? Would you be able to send all those images for verification? No. Yeah. You know, what we rely upon are really good eyes. We're looking at something, you know, that doesn't quite look right. A little flag goes up, and then we study it more carefully. I've done that from time to time and then did the research. And you know what? Sometimes I find, no, that image really is true. And a lot of other times, nope, that something happened with that image.
Well, sometimes, you know, there is this phrase that usually ends up getting people caught. That's too perfect. You know, life is not perfect, and we are not, as photographers, you know, perfect. And so when it comes to digital manipulation, you know, that's where it begins. You kind of look at it and go. The other thing is, a major newspaper or a major news organization on a big news day could have as many as 10 or 15,000 images come in a day. And there are people that are paid to go through those. You cannot possibly run all those through, you know, some sort of device. But what happens sometimes is when you have an event, and it could be something as simple as a baseball game, you might have multiple photographers there. And so what may pop up is you may see a difference from one photograph to the other. And then that raises alarms. I'll give you an example. There was a photographer in Ohio, in central Ohio, that was shooting a simple baseball game. And he manipulated this picture. And it was brought to my attention while I happened to be there about, well, what do you think about this? The staff photographer at this other newspaper showed me their picture and then showed me this other picture, and clearly something was missing. And so we passed it on, and it ended up he'd cloned it out. And not only had he cloned it out there, but then his publication rightly went through all of his work, and they found dozens.
Just as the New Republic did with Stephen Glass.
Exactly. They found dozens of instances. And, you know, and the excuse was, as I sort of alluded to earlier, was, you know, I was just looking to make the pictures more better, more perfect. And you just can't do that.
And he that was after he'd been questioned several times, because I even emailed him, because on his blog, one of the things he put is like, well, it's Easter, and, you know, nobody is perfect. Even the man, you know, who we see is perfect. And he also then at one point he claimed, well, I was doing that one for my wall because I was emotionally involved with the issue. And,
yeah. You know, Evan, I think one of the things that kind of you can draw a correlation to from all this is that, you know, there's a tight group of photojournalists that are policing our own industry. There's folks who have a very strong sense of moral obligation to keep on top of this. And so, you know, photojournalists are their best source of policing. I don't know if we need to build algorithms. I think maybe, you know, more conversations between the industry within the industry to keep our colleagues in check or point out issues of impropriety in imaging. But you know, we're sometimes our best critics.
I got a question from Barry about the Ted Cruz photo. I don't know if you saw it last week. So here's the story. Easy to find if you Google this. Ted Cruz was speaking at a shooting range, and AP photographer Charlie Niebergall took a picture of Ted Cruz at the shooting range. Now, in the background, there was an image of a handgun, and the way it was pointed and the way Ted Cruz was standing made it look like the gun was pointed directly at his head.
And it was a very big illustration.
Very big
gun.
Illustration. I mean, it looks like a gun pointed directly at Ted Cruz's head. The photo ran. Ted Cruz was furious about it, and the AP essentially retreated after that. He said it was designed to be inflammatory. What does our panel think about that? Well, Barry, our listener, wants to know, what does the panel think?
Well, I mean, you know, I would have taken that picture. Whether I would have moved it on the wire remains to be seen.
That's the difference.
You know, and yeah, I think the AP did something really silly by moving it, at least as a news picture.
When you say by moving it, by using it, by
moving it across their network to all the news organizations. But here's the other thing, too. It's like, okay, Ted Cruz has really well-paid individuals that are supposed to come into these places and sort of scout locations and make sure everything is really good. And it gets back to a conversation that we haven't really had. It's sort of like how politicians and athletes and stars and et cetera, manipulate scenes to for the good. Who is his advance person? Mm-hmm. That person should be, I'm not going to say shot, but that person, you know, should really be called on the carpet. They never should allow that to happen.
But now, go ahead, Max. You know, to be honest, though, you know, Ted Cruz was speaking at a shooting range. Mm-hmm. Okay, Ted Cruz was talking to pro-gun constituents. I'm trying to walk a fine line here where, yes, you know, in some way you need to show that Ted Cruz is a gun, is supporting gun rights and talking to constituents that are in support of gun rights. So how do you try and convey that? Was that the best way to do it? Maybe you could have made a different angle and gotten those guns maybe a little smaller. Maybe there was another way to add some more people into this. But I see where the photographer was going. He was trying to make that connection. The gun pointed directly in his head maybe might have not been the best way to do it.
But that wasn't staged. To Max and to William's point, that was a natural shot,
correct,
not staged.
Not
whereas
staged.
Before the hour began, Lorette, you showed me a picture of Paul Ryan in the presidential campaign, his last campaign when he was running for vice president. And a photographer shows up, I guess, at a soup kitchen, and Paul Ryan and his wife had been serving. Now, they got there late.
They hadn't been serving.
I'm sorry.
No, they walked in, lunch was over.
Oh, Paul,
everything
I see.
Was
so Paul
over.
Ryan hadn't even served.
So they're wearing, they're washing clean pots.
They're washing
clean
pots.
And if it hadn't been for the photographers are going to do their job. They don't want to go back and tell their editor, I didn't make any
But
pictures.
I would, if I'm the photographer, I would have taken a shot of Paul Ryan trying to get a stage photo of washing. That would have been the story
Well,
of
that's
me.
What they did. They took the photographs, but they made sure their editors understood the context.
Interesting.
I gave a panel to a professional organization about 5 years ago. I guess a little bit more than 5 years ago because Michelle Bachmann was running. One of the photographers, Brandon Hoffman, had come down to join us just so, you know, as he was covering her campaign, so we could talk about candidates, political candidates, and the ways that they manipulate the photographer, the
sure.
ways that they manipulate the stories. Well, one of the people who actually joined our panel, and I'm still quite surprised that he did, and I'm not going to name him, worked for George W. Bush. During his second term. And he was responsible for everything that went around Bush, no matter where he appeared outside of the White House. And so he would talk about, he's just 18 inches, 18 inches. You control on either side of his head, you're good as gold. And he, you know, he told us these stories. I mean, he rode in Bush's truck at his ranch and stuff, so that he was there every bit of it. What you were talking about, the handler had full control and knows these things. Adam would have just had a brain fit if he had seen that photograph, the possibility for that. Because like in some of these photographs, the photographers are limited to a 4-foot space on the floor.
Sure.
There's no other picture they can make.
Yeah, you're all getting the same angle. Real briefly, how does this panel feel about the very term photo op?
Well, I mean, you know, in this day and age of highly controlled politicians and things like that, you get what you can get, and you send really good people that are going to try to do their best to work around that in any way possible. So they try to shoot things off on the edges, off moments, things like that. I'll give you an example, a very quick example. It wasn't a politician, but it was we used to cover the Dallas Cowboys, of course. And one of their many coaches had resigned or gotten fired or something. And so there's all the podium shots and everything. But there's this great moment where he walked off and the equipment manager sort of patted him on the back and the shoulder as he walked off. And I thought that was just a wonderful moment. And so that's the picture we led on page one. People were furious because they thought we had taken a cheap shot at him, you know, because it wasn't the sanitized just him standing up at the podium maybe crying or being upset or something. It was this wonderful human moment between the equipment manager and the former coach, and people just didn't, you know, they thought we were taking a cheap shot.
How, like, dare you get
a real moment.
It's
like,
that's right.
Well, you also bring
William
up
has
the
four
audience.
Pulitzers.
Yes.
We're down to our last 15 seconds. Go ahead, Loretta.
We also bring up the other issue. We always look at the photographer's responsibility, but the audience is demanding more entertainment. The audience wants the cheap and easy. That's consistently what gets hit.
Well, Max Schulte, the last word with you as the lead photographer of the Democrat and Chronicle. Are you an optimist now? I mean, we've seen some staff cuts and you're working in different ways, different media. Are you an optimist going forward on the future of this medium?
You know, there's tons of studies out there right now. You know, the social realm is here to stay, and all of the studies that point to how people are engaging on that is visually. So yes, I'm an optimist.
We're going to keep watching your work, and
thank
I
you.
Enjoyed this conversation tremendously. I wish I had
Thanks
another
for
hour.
Having us.
Thank you for being here. And Loretta and William, I wish I could take your classes. You have very
well, of course you can.
You have very
Come
fortunate
on.
Students
Absolutely.
At RIT. My intern, Caitlin Madison, just might. A short break, and we're talking to Joe Morelli next hour. Stay with me.